Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
There is just over a week until polling day, so it's really not long now until Ireland's 10th president is elected. But away from all of the campaigning and the debates and the canvassing, we're going to take a look now at how, as a country, we came to have a president in the first place. And I'm joined by Professor of Modern Irish History, Dermot Ferriter, and archivist Katrina Crowe, who've come together to present a brand new history podcast for RTE. It's called What Were We Like? And the first episode deals with this very topic. So it's all very timely, and you're both welcome. Great to have you here.
Great to be here.
So,
thank you, Claire.
Well, let's start with the basic question. Why do we have a president, Dermot? You might take that one for us.
We went back and looked at the various drafts of the constitution that were being proposed in 1936 and 1937 when they first felt they needed the architecture, the constitutional architecture of a republic. And the idea was that there would be a head of state. It was largely envisaged as a ceremonial role. And there had been a governor general previously to represent the crown in Ireland and perform those ceremonial duties like opening parliament and signing legislation. So it was partly envisaged to be an Irish form of governor general. But there were added bits. And I don't think people appreciate the various different proposals that were there about how much power a president might actually have. Mm-hmm. You know, should they at any stage be in a position to interfere if things go wrong politically? Should they be providing the state with a kind of an anchor in case of troubled times? Or should they just be completely above that political fray? What we end up with is a mix, really. You know, most of the powers of the president can only be exercised on the advice of the government. There are specific powers that they have that they can initiate themselves, but they are very few and they are not employed very often. And what we got interested in, I suppose, is how was this viewed at the very beginning? And it brings you on to less well-known characters like Michael McDonoghue, who was the first secretary to the first president. And he went out of his way to ensure there was a respect for the office and that it was seen as an important role and an important symbol. And what we've had in the decades since, very contentious assertions about what the presidency actually is and what it can be. And those debates didn't just begin in 1990 with the election of Mary Robinson talking about an active presidency or a new style of presidency. There's plenty of evidence there to suggest that there were various people toying with the idea of an active presidency mm-hmm. well before that, but they were shot down.
Well, I'm sure, Katrina, you've seen from the archives and you'll tell us about it, that there were suspicions and fears around what this role would, should and could be.
Yes, well, remember, we're in the 1930s, Claire, and what's happening in Europe, the rise of Nazism. In 1937, Hitler has been in power for 4 years since 1933 and is assuming more and more autocratic powers all the time. The rest of Europe is gradually going in that direction. And it's a frightening time. So it's also a time when people are thinking about this kind of corporatist idea that you could have a very powerful president. But the resistance to the original proposals is so strong that De Valera eventually uses the famous phrase, "I think the president should be a hurler on the ditch," mm-hmm. giving me a view of what's going on in the national interest, which is sufficiently anodyne to satisfy any people who feared that the president might have the powers, for example, of the president of the United States, which are extraordinary, as we're beginning to
yes.
see, to our horror.
And was there a comfort then in that hurler on the ditch description? That satisfied people.
There certainly wasn't. And I mean, this is the point, I suppose, about there were very rancorous Dáil debates. The constitution, the draft constitution was debated in the Dáil in the spring of 1937 into the early summer for 90 hours in total. Uh-huh. And 27 of those 90 hours were devoted to the presidency. And people were very suspicious of it and what it might become, that it was sowing the seeds for a potentially all-powerful president. So there's a lot of suspicion about it. But interestingly, Douglas Hyde was our first president. Mm-hmm. He didn't have to go through an election, obviously. He was an agreed candidate and he was seen as really a reservoir of cultural symbolism and identity. Mm-hmm. But he sat down with Michael McDonoghue, his secretary, on the first day and he said, "What's this job involve?" Mm-hmm. And McDonoghue went through various things. And, you know, the way Hyde concluded was that, so in the event of the game getting ugly, I have to be the referee who takes out the whistle.
Get off the ditch.
And he used to say occasionally, because the sporting analogy is there all the time, he used to say occasionally to McDonoghy during his presidency, if things were getting a bit heated, with a twinkle in his eye, is it time to get out the whistle?
Yeah.
But I mean, even when was time to get out the whistle, that led to an awful lot of tension.
So it was Mr. McDonoghy really who designed this role, who came up with what it should look like and should be. Is that fair to say?
Well, Dermot would argue that, and I'd agree with him. He wrote a book about it, saying what the roles, responsibilities and restraints of the presidency were, which I think a lot of people consulted over the years and regarded as the obiter dicta for what a president was supposed to do and not do. So you've had powerful people like that, but McDonoghy stands out as somebody who really did defend the president's ground. I think, Dermot, you pointed out that he wrote to the newspaper saying, we do not want to be seeing any stuff about royal activities in Britain placed ahead of what the president's social calendar might be.
Mm-hmm. You know, he should take precedence over that stuff.
He was referred to by one of his critics at the time as an officious ass, for someone who was very hostile to him. And he was officious, but he was officious in the best way, because what he was trying to do was carve out a space and a respect for the office. But the book he wrote is very formal, obviously, and it's very legalistic, and it sets out precisely where and when the president can act in a particular way. But the reality, of course, that comes out of the archive behind the scenes is that there is an awful lot of disagreement and tension about just what this will mean in practice.
Mm-hmm. When? When did, well, that, I mean, if when you did take, those tensions
example,
arise?
I mean, even at the stage, the idea that a president can refuse to dissolve a Dáil if a Taoiseach has lost the authority of the Dáil. And, you know, De Valera made a visit to Douglas Hyde at night in Áras an Uachtaráin to try and persuade him after he had lost a vote, which was not a vote of confidence, to persuade him to dissolve the Dáil. He had the power to refuse that dissolution and was minded to it, but was persuaded to do otherwise. And the accusations in the Dáil of late night treachery in the Phoenix Park. And of course, that blew up again in 1982 in relation to the efforts by Fianna Fáil, including Charles Haughey, to persuade Patrick Hillary not to dissolve the Dáil after Fine Gael Labour lost a budget vote. And I suppose one of the advantages of looking at it now is that we can go back and look at what was being said privately. Patrick Hillary was freed, I suppose, as he saw it, from his incarceration after 14 years and was able to speak more frankly about what had happened. So new information comes into the domain, which can often involve revisiting some well-aired controversies and getting new perspectives on
them. So that's what you're doing on this podcast. You're going back, but you're delving down into the layers that we can see now, sometimes for the first time, Katrina.
Yeah, that's absolutely. But it's also the case that just in ordinary terms, people forget. We have a presidential election every 7 years and people forget what the rules are. You know, they have to be. I have to be re-educated every time we have a general election as to how PR works, because the distribution of votes is so complicated. Mm-hmm. So you've got to educate yourself on that. And really, it's about what can the president do and not do. And we're able to tell people that they can't, for example, deal with major political issues like the housing crisis or health or so forth. Dermot has outlined one of the ways they can have an effect, which has never actually been put into operation. The other one is referring a bill to the Supreme Court. And of course, that right led to a huge explosion in 1976, when Carol O'Dolig referred the Emergency Powers Bill to the Supreme Court to test its constitutionality. It was called a thundering disgrace by Paddy Donegan, who was the Minister for Defence, who apologised in a half-hearted way, should have been sacked by Liam Cosgrave, who was the Taoiseach, a Taoiseach who did not come to visit President O'Dolig to keep him apprised of events, as he was supposed to do under the Constitution. And eventually O'Dolig resigns and dies 2 years later. So this had a shattering effect on him. The bill was declared to be constitutional, which carries with it its own threats. This is why it's a serious power. If the president refers a bill to the Supreme Court and it's found to be constitutional, it cannot be challenged again.
And then, see, one of the advantages, I suppose, of the public positions and then the private reality, you can go into the private papers of Carúl O'Dolig and ask yourself what was going through his mind at that time. And he's left us an awful lot of his reflections. Personalities matter hugely in relation to the presidency and temperament. Yeah. And also those who were very frustrated with what they saw as unnecessary restrictions on their freedom to movement. Even in 1966 and 1973, Tom O'Higgins was a Fine Gael candidate who nearly beat De Valera in 1966. He was promising a new style of presidency, a youthful, vigorous type of president. Erskine Childers famously promised that he would convene think tanks on some of the major issues of the day. And he found himself really a prisoner in the Oris, as he put it. I was put out to grass. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those who are going in are quite trepidatious because they know maybe some of the things that they have committed to during the campaign are going to be very difficult to implement.
Now, people can hear more about this on this podcast called What Were We Like? And I just want to find out a little bit more about how the two of you were flung together to talk about these things for long periods of time, which we can hear now. How did this happen? Katrina.
Well, we've known each other for over 30 years.
Right.
And we've been blathering to each other for over 30 years. So basically, this is us sitting in the Swan Bar on a Friday evening talking about whatever happens to come into our minds.
I love it.
So it's not exactly as structured as people might expect.
But that's what we want.
And we have a lot of fun, it must be said.
There's great fun in the presidency too.
And do you agree on these topics that you're discussing?
More or less.
No. What are you talking about?
Come on. Be conciliatory.
What would be the point in agreement? No, I mean, these are the things that there are different perspectives that you have. Yeah. Can I raise the delicate issue of generational difference as well? Is that allowed?
If you want to do that, but beware of what's going to happen to you afterwards.
But there are things Katrina can remember that I, for obvious reasons, cannot because I was not there. Mm. Katrina was actually in the Oris in 1966. As a child with Eamon De Valera, which
sitting
I obviously
was.
Sitting
on his knee, which is creepy.
And of course, Katrina has a particular wisdom as a result of her big brain and also her life
flattery
experience.
Flattery gets you everywhere.
So you do. You have to bring the different experiences that you have to it, you know. And obviously, both of us have been immersed in archival material throughout our careers.
Yeah, but it's interesting because I'm sure both of you have come away, you know, you've gone through the same archives and you might come away with a different opinion. And I'm sure that happens in these conversations as well.
But so much of the presidency is about personality. You know, we're still at odds, really, as to what the president is supposed to be. Are they meant to embody some idea of the Irish nation and the Irish people? Do they have to be a president for all the people, in which case you might be representing some people that you don't agree with or don't like. We know they have limited powers. So one of the episodes of our podcast is going to be focusing on vision, symbolism and values, the things the president actually can do.
Yeah.
And I would argue that Mary Robinson was the person who opened up the presidency to allow for those things with things like
and we also got interested in the people who did not want to be president.
We need to stick the record button on here because you're practically making another episode of it. But if people want to hear the episodes that have been released, you can get them on the RTE radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. It's called What Were We Like? It's about the history of the presidency. The first three episodes are out now. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us today.